Going here too. Sick. I think we're ready to go, man. All right, I'm going to do a little intro because that's what I'd like to do. I've got my Asahi ready to go just in case I get thirsty. And we go. So you got your kit, everything. All right, here we go. Greetings. This is Fernando. Welcome to F69F. Today, I am talking to one of my really good friends. We've been friends forever. His name is Alberto Martinez, and he is one of two of the famous band, Neuropa. Now, they're famous.
Infamous.
Okay, well, welcome to our video. Now, we brought you on, or I brought you on, because you have a brand new album.
We do, yes.
And there's obviously a lot of hard work and a lot of sweat and tears goes behind this stuff. So obviously the reason I wanted to talk to you is because I wanted to learn more about that process, learn more about you, and hopefully we get to learn a bit about, you know, what makes Neuropa tick and what makes you, you know, sort of keep on coming back. Because which album number, what is it now?
This is like album 10.
And how long has it been, the band been together? Obviously.
So our first album was in 95.
That's right.
New Faith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just so I actually took some of the pictures for that album.
Yeah, you yes.
Yes, I did. Yeah. So that's my claim to fame. So my claim to fame is that I actually I had a DSLR in those days, and we went out to some Chinese gardens in, I think it was Auburn.
Rookwood Cemetery.
It wasn't in a cemetery. It was in a Chinese gardens.
Yeah.
And you guys,
it's part of that cemetery.
Oh, is it now?
It is, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And so we took some really kind of cool pictures, and they went on the cover.
That's when I used to be pretty.
That's right. Mm. But you are too pretty, but you know, it's in the eye of the beholder. That's what, you know, everyone says, right?
Yeah, true.
But the thing is that was that also a cassette? Or was it just a CD?
No, it was a CD. It was a CD release at the time. Yeah, that's right. And with that particular album, we released it as, we did it ourselves. And it wasn't until afterwards that we were able to get signed to a label in the US, a different drum based in Utah. And from that point, they kind of got involved in our development and put us on the roster of artists that were doing similar music, synth pop music, and then they supported us with further releases from there on. But with the first album, we did it ourselves. We thought, like, at the time, we were pretty much one of the few bands, or maybe we thought at the time that we were like one of the only bands doing that kind of music. And it wasn't until we reached out and got in touch with Todd at a different drum that it dawned on us that, no, there's actually a lot of other bands that are doing this kind of music, and they've never stopped doing that kind of music in Europe and in America. And so it just, like, opened the doors for us. It was really good. It's amazing.
So Little Ol' Australia. So obviously, you I know very well. We sort of grew up together. And music almost came at a record store. We had to line up for releases, and there was a limited release. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to us, it was almost like a gift from above, right? So this was the first album pre-internet?
No, it wasn't pre-internet, no, because by that point, I think, I mean, I was a very early adopter. Very early adopter of the internet, so I was already on kind of bulletin boards and things like that, even on the Atari when I was using that for sequencing, which was all done in the early 90s.
That's right. Atari was a powerful computer.
I don't know about so powerful, but it was one of the first computers that had built-in MIDI, so you could actually use it for sequencing. And so it became really popular for that. So I had one of those. And so I would go online and kind of go onto bulletin boards and email people and that kind of thing. So it was before web pages and all that kind of thing was happening.
Life before HTML. Did that even exist?
It was before that. Yep. But by the time that our first album came out, New Faith, I think web pages had kind of already started, and you had your first internet browsers, like Netscape. That was before, like, we didn't have Internet Explorer or any of that kind of stuff. It was Netscape, and it was very rudimentary.
That's right.
But we'd set up a web page. I was very, very into the whole idea of setting up, you know, web pages and all that kind of thing. So I had set up a web page for the band, and I was very motivated to get things happening.
Yeah, because it was Netscape and Lycos were the big browsers, and this is before Yahoo made it big.
Yeah, there were no, as far as I remember, there weren't really any very large kind of search engines or that kind of thing. That was before all this technology had kind of really started.
Yeah, so I do remember, obviously. When you used to talk about that first album, you guys were very proud of it, and obviously it was a labor of love to get it out there. But then I always wondered why you had to go all the way to the US to actually get a label to actually record it, or at least release it. You never found anyone similar minded in Australia to help you out with that?
I think in Australia, we were felt a little bit isolated, I think, because Australia had kind of, particularly during that time, there wasn't very much interest in that kind of music. Whereas in Europe and in the US, it had never kind of waned. There'd already been people who just stayed very interested in that kind of music. That was their taste, and that was what I was like, and Jason was very similar. So we just never stopped listening to that kind of music. And so we found that there were like-minded people in Europe and the US. But it was very much a happen chance type scenario. It wasn't really like we didn't know anything about what was happening in the rest of the world. We just were living in a bubble, and we just never stopped listening to that kind of music.
Yeah.
And we just thought, well, that's all we can really do, because that's what we love.
Mm.
That's what we grew up doing.
So now that music's evolved so much since the 80s, and obviously it was electronic music in the 80s, right? Is that what you would categorize it? And what is it called now? I mean, how do you give it a distinct sort of label?
So I think now it's pretty much the same kind of style of music. It's still kind of called synth pop, or we call it, I like to call it electro pop, because it's very much based on catchy, our music, Neuropa's music, very much based on catchy lyrics, catchy melodies, catchy riffs in the music. And that's really what drives it. And I think that's kind of what identifies that kind of music. So you could also play that kind of music on any instrument, and really it's still going to hold together. You could play it on a guitar and it's still going to hold together, because it's essentially still a pop song. So irrespective of what instrumentation, it's like, I think of the instrumentation as window dressing, and it's just what we happen to really, really love is the instrumentation, but it's not what identifies it as holding together. You could hold it together with just a guitar if you needed to.
Yeah, because and that obviously that brings up a good point, because your, I guess, genre relies a lot on that electronic, and it tends to be expensive, right? So it could be an expensive hobby or expensive. Would you classify
everything
it?
We touch is expensive. If it's not expensive, we don't want to know about it.
Because what I find is that there's definitely some sort of feels, or just, let's say, genres of music which will not require as much juice to keep it running. Is it something that you've ever considered?
I've never touched a ukulele.
But what about your carbon footprint? That's what I'm getting
to. I don't really care. As long as it's massive. Yeah, look, I mean, Jason's studio is ridiculous. It looks like a synthesizer warehouse. And mine's pretty bad as well. So as far as carbon footprint, we're probably responsible for half of what China's producing. but we the good thing is that we use every we use every instrument that we have for what we do. So we don't just overindulge.
Yeah, yeah. Because I was obviously it's a beautiful technology, and it's just evolved so much since the old days. I remember your first synth, you had to put in a floppy disk into it.
Yeah. So that was my second synth. Oh, so you're talking about the SQ80, Sonic SQ80, which I absolutely still love. And interestingly enough, tomorrow I'm going to buy an old Windows PC just so that I can be able to retrieve the data off those old discs, because those old discs have a lot of my old music from the 80s and 90s that I'm trying to retrieve, because I lost all these old cassettes. So before that I had a Juno 106, which now, I don't know, it would be worth about $2,000, but at the time I just bought it for like $300 from a shop in the, I think it was in Gosford, actually, that I ended up getting a secondhand analog synthesizer and used it for a few years and performed with you when we were in school.
Oh my God.
Do you remember that?
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah.
It was scary because I actually had to learn something. You know, it's funny because I always had a penchant for, you know, getting on a stage, but...
You've always been a performer.
Yes, but only when it's so much effort is involved. When you have to learn lyrics of... I don't know how some people do an entire concert. I had enough problems listening, you know, understanding or at least learning lyrics for a couple of songs, let alone... You know, full 2 hour spread of songs. That was kind of crazy. But it was good experience from
it's
that.
Because you've got that distracting voice in your head that says, I'm amazing. I'm incredible.
I don't think anyone thinks that I'm amazing. I have to use some serious technology, as in Rode. He's a shout out to Rode. Hopefully we get some free stuff. but, you know, to actually do this magic that we do. So, obviously, you've been, developed technique as the years have come back. The style of music stayed the same, but...
Essentially, yeah.
But you've learned new tricks?
I'm constantly learning. And that's part of what I love about what I do is really kind of honing the skills and really getting, just constantly improving and doing, trying different things with the way we write, the approach to songwriting and recording and synthesizers and the whole thing. I love it. And part of what I really love about doing electronic music is that exploration of new technology and opportunities to try different things and just continually evolve. I think I don't think we'd survive as purely a rock band, because we'd probably get bored just from doing the same thing over and over. The song structures and things like that are pretty much similar, like from what we used to do back in the 90s. But what's evolved is just the approach to the recording process and the technology. I think that's quite an exciting thing, and it just keeps you interested and motivated.
Yeah, absolutely, because there is time between each album, right? So, you know, you
usually about 2 to 3 years or at least. Yeah,
yeah. And so that's a lot in the world of technology, 2 to 3 years, there's a lot of
change. It does, it evolves. It's constantly evolving. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And both Jason and I are constantly, acquiring new equipment or like I'm always learning new things, because I'm often more responsible for the kind of final production part of the music, and so I'm always learning new things, and more recently really developing my skills in mastering Which is a kind of black art in itself. It's the very final stage of recording and releasing music. And that whole process is I find it always really fascinating. And learning from people who are very knowledgeable and have always really been passionate about the technology, and always learning about what people who are really like experts, specialists in their field, and what they've got to offer everybody else. I love that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely like you said, there is this. Would you say it was an underground community, or is it just it's just not loud enough to be heard from that electronic music?
Well, I think electronic music now is kind of almost the default status of music, because everything's electronic in a way. It's more like the sub categories of electronic music is very divergent. You've got a lot of different subcategories now, which is very interesting. And what I find is quite egalitarian about the whole thing with music and electronic music is that it's very open to for anybody to do music now. And that's, I mean, pretty much anyone with any kind of technology, an iPad, you can do music now. Nothing stops you from doing music. But it was back in the 80s and the 90s even, unless you had, like, the equipment itself and the technology was restrictive. Unless you had a lot of money and you had the technology, you weren't able to really access it. So now it's completely exploded, and anyone can really, the only thing stopping you is your ideas.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, and you actually, I think, hit the nail on the head. And when I was talking to you about the tech and the investment in tech, to be able to create that type of music, obviously it meant that you needed that investment. And obviously it was mom and dad or the part-time job and things like that. But now it's an iPad, practically.
Yeah.
Right?
And well, back in the day, like, I used to spend pretty much everything I earned on music and equipment, and I've spent so much money over the years. Like, I remember when samplers first came out, and I had an Akai S1000. I had like every type of Akai sampler you can imagine, because they were like the biggest samplers at the time. And I had an S950 and an S1000, S1100, and then I sold it and bought an emulator, which had beautiful filters on it and all this kind of thing. And I just spent so much money. I think I spent about $6,500 on an Emax, and then I realized I didn't really like the sound of it, even though I should have. And just the constant, like, shift with equipment, you know, it just became this kind of roller coaster of, like, equipment. Whereas now it's more about, well, you can have whatever you want, really. It's just all on the one piece of equipment. If you want to just write on a computer or an iPad, you can. So, I mean, I've got the best of both worlds. I've got equipment in a studio, and I've got a lot of hardware, but I've also got a lot on a computer, because I like working that way. But there's nothing stopping anybody anymore, which is fantastic.
Yeah. So then obviously, I think the thing that stops me and many other people from wanting to be these musos is obviously that creative juice, right? Now, you definitely have to have that formula in order to create songs and write them, and there's lyrics and tunes, and obviously there's a lot of, make sure that you don't sort of copy, and, you know, that's hard work as well. Is that what the three-year gap between one album and another, is that what some of that time is spent on?
Yeah, so, I mean, between albums, we're very much kind of working on new music and writing, and really we're very fussy about what we're doing, because we want to put out good quality music. So we don't take shortcuts, and we are not going to release something unless we're happy with it. And particularly now, like, there's no pressure on us to put anything out. We don't have any labels on our backs or anything like that. And I think a lot of artists feel the same way. They don't really have anybody on their back anymore. I think the music industry's kind of collapsed in that regard. You don't really have labels, you know, telling you what to do anymore or any of that. Like, artists really have to create their own success.
Yeah.
And work towards getting their own audience. And I think live performance is the biggest thing. It's if you don't perform live and really kind of work towards getting an audience happening, it's very difficult. Mm. So the time between albums for us, it's really about, well, what do we want to do next? But we don't want to feel that pressure of doing things like in back in the day, I think in that, you know, in the 80s or earlier, a band would go into a studio and just have like, okay, you've got 2 weeks, record your album. That's it. That's all you're getting.
Yeah.
And then you're out. And so that's like a pressure cooker to just produce whatever it is that you've got at the time, and you've got a producer there and all this kind of thing. Whereas now most albums are self-produced. It's very, very unusual to, or not as common to have albums produced by a producer in a studio, because most people do it themselves in these days.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I guess from an Australian perspective, I do remember that whole, yeah, and I'm not sure how many years ago it is now. It's probably 3 or 4 years ago since, you know, Gautier wrote that album. It went like worldwide. He won Grammys. And then he's kind of, I think, gone back into his cave.
Disappeared.
So obviously that, but that's great, because obviously now he's sort of, I guess if that's the best case scenario, there's so many kids and talented people now that can, like you said, produce their own stuff and then put it out there and then always get that success. But that's always a tough thing for me. It was always like, you know, what is success? Is success something that allows you to do what you do every day or every few years to write the music that you want to write and then put it out there? Or is it the rich and famous? I mean, what is it for you? Is money, has that been a driver for you at any time in your history?
Not musically. For me, it's always been about quality.
Mm.
And doing what we do as good as we can possibly be, and that's striving to be really like high quality. It's always been the same thing, and Jason feels the same way. It's all about quality. Mm. And I think, and that's kind of like a process that you go through, because you're constantly striving for that.
Yeah. So that's good. I think a lot of this social culture today of instant success or whatever. I mean, the Justin Biebers and people like that who had started their career on YouTube and then all of a sudden they're a big hit. I mean, that's something that I still find is a one in a million, but people still think that that's something that could be easily achieved, and I think it's not a realistic ambition to have.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people kind of have an idea that their happiness lies over there on the horizon somewhere, and if they can just get close to it, it's gonna make them happy. But I think if you don't really have a clear goal in mind already, then you're setting yourself up for failure in terms of what your expectations are. Because once you get what you think you wanted, you probably think, oh, that wasn't really what I wanted or what I needed.
Yeah.
Whereas what we've always wanted to achieve is not these other things. It's just excellence at music.
Yeah.
Because it's what we love. And as long as we've always wanted to do music, like, you know, you've known me for a really long time and you've known that I've just been passionate about music.
Mm.
And so that's my main drive.
Yeah.
It's just explore that to the nth degree.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break and then we'll be right back after we, top up our drinks and we'll get back to it. Thanks, Albert.
Thank you.
And we're back. Thank you very much, Albert, for sticking around and not sort of running the heck out of here.
I wouldn't.
So the... There's plenty more wine left, so I'm sure you're going to stick around for that.
I will.
So the new album.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about it. So what is the name and then the sort of songs that are in the album? What was the inspiration this time around?
So, yeah, okay. Close to Midnight, new album, Europa. And we're very excited with this particular album. We think our songwriting and our production is really gotten to a place that we're very happy with. The songs on the album, the quality of the songwriting, the progression, I think it's very much in line with our style and our ethos, which is pretty much pure synth pop. I think we've really nailed it with this particular album. We're really happy with it.
Yeah, I'd agree. I had listened to it, and obviously I've been sneaky. I've been sneaky and listened to all your releases and your catalog and stuff like that. And I do feel, you know, that it's complete. It has just very sort of complete, you know, feel to it. You know, the vocals, are really cool. I think you really come into your age, feeling comfortable about your style and Jason's voice too sounds great. So he's definitely matured with that. Just like a good wine, Jason. You're just definitely getting better. That's absolutely right. So, you know, you've had a different distribution. And what I wanted to do is mainly from an education perspective, right? So you've tried a lot of distribution methods. We talked about your early career where you had talked to someone in the US to get you on there. But now it's all digital distribution, right?
So these days we use CD Baby. So they will pretty much distribute the album to all the digital platforms, Spotify, iTunes, Tidal, etc. We're on Bandcamp, so we're able to pretty much connect with our audience that way. We will sell merchandise that way as well. So it's really flexible. We don't really need a label. When we did have a label, it was a good time to have a label at the time because you still needed to have CDs and you still needed to be able to network that way. Whereas these days, the whole landscape's changed.
Mm.
So as long as you're able to connect with your audience, we've got a pretty loyal following, and those fans who are into our music they're quite loyal to what we do because we've been around a little while.
So unlike my Facebook, not my Facebook, but my YouTube channel, do you get any thumbs down?
Never.
Of course, I never
wouldn't dare. So I get very upset.
That's right. No more albums for
There's
you.
There's always a price to pay for a thumbs down.
So then obviously
no one gets away unscathed.
Personally speaking, I truly believe that no one gets away from Albert.
No.
So let me ask you a little bit about obviously the music and the production yet again, because we went a long time ago writing the songs that we did when we were kids on obviously cassette tapes, right?
Perfect Lover.
The Perfect Lover was that mystery. It was like the fish that got away, or that, you know, like, you know, it was a hit to happen, but it just obviously we lost it. We just didn't have the right media. We didn't have backups in those days unless you recorded the same cassette 10 times. But now it's very easy to be able to produce high quality music, right? But
it's easy to the equipment makes it very easy, but it doesn't mean that the material is good.
Mm.
So that's always going to be the same thing, you know. Like if you're good, if you're writing a good song, it's going to translate no matter what you do.
Yeah.
So you could just write it on, you know. I heard recently, because I'm really into Prince, listening to him just record a demo on guitar of the song Kiss, and it sounded fantastic. And then I heard the recorded version, and it still sounded fantastic. But the song translates either way.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So if you're a talented songwriter, then it's going to come across either way.
Yeah.
And I think it's the tools are just the tools. Like it could be, they're just like, you know, colors
yeah.
that you're using on a paintbrush or your painting or whatever.
Yeah.
It's the same type of thing. It's just a tool.
Well, I'm glad you raised Prince, because Prince was never an advocate for digital, let's say, reduction in media. He held back a long time with CDs. He actually would put label or warnings on his CDs to let you know that this was a like a lesser version of his.
Prince had some weird ideas.
Yeah. But then he also never did streaming. I mean, never went to Spotify, never went to anything like that. Obviously he had this big idea that what you were getting was the reduced version of the actual artistic invention that he had.
I think with Prince, he's very acutely aware of how the medium at the moment, and Spotify is kind of not just Spotify, but a lot of the streaming services are really they're not really paying musicians.
Mm.
And Prince has always been very acutely aware of that kind of thing, you know, in terms of the music industry and being taken advantage of, and so he was always very, very savvy.
Yeah.
As far as that goes. That was one of the big reasons he had the big fallout with his record label and what have you. So,
absolutely. Like, that was the whole big Warner Brothers fight with his identity.
And it dictated a lot around his life around that time. And you know, it's interesting, but at the same time, it was a little bit sad because of the fact that it swallowed up so much time.
Yeah.
You know, where he could have just been creating music, because he was just such an incredible creative force on the planet. You know, there's still thousands and thousands of songs that haven't seen the light of day in his massive archive.
Yeah.
You know.
So do you think the fact that he wanted that ultimate complete control of his music and that sort of made it difficult for him to be able to, let's say, navigate through the changing face of what music became? I mean, we went from, you know, CDs to, like, you know, like Napster to MP3.
I think with Prince, he never wanted to be taken advantage of.
Mm.
I think that was really the crux of it. He wanted to be recognized and not being taken advantage of. Was really the one of the big reasons why he behaved the way he did and had those issues with his record label and all that kind of thing. But in the same breath, it kind of took up a lot of his life during that whole time, you know.
Yeah.
Probably close to a decade of his life was swallowed up by that whole what was going on.
Yeah. And the fact that he fought it and it was very resilient, but he went from losing his music at the time through Warner Brothers to losing his name to his face.
Yeah.
And it was almost like
it was
a war of attrition as far as concerned.
He wasn't the only one, because George Michael went through a very similar thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't. He wasn't just isolated. And he gave a lot of advice to George Michael about that.
Yeah. So how do you think now in this day and age, and we did touch on Spotify about not giving artists enough of the, let's say, royalties for their music. Is that...
Well, you're talking about like fractions, like 0.0001 of a cent. It doesn't even qualify as a cent.
Yeah.
You know, for each time something's played on the online, which is... You know, and we could gripe about that kind of thing, but I think eventually it will change. The whole situation will change because it's unsustainable for musicians to be able to do that. Because it feels like Napster,
yeah,
right now. And that's what it feels like for musicians.
Napster was free. It was good quality MP3s, Albert.
I know. I was downloading like pretty much my whole library on Napster. So I guess it's karmic.
Well, there was no rules in those days.
It's a karmic kind of payback that I'm meant to be poor forever.
That's right. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But hey, you know, the laws weren't there at the time. And
no.
And everyone likes something for free, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going to get into another discussion, but I think we need to have a bit of dinner.
Yeah, let's have some Thai.
Yes. Welcome back, Albert. How was that Thai?
That was delicious.
Yeah.
So really was delicious.
Yeah. If we could get some shout outs to Uber Eats, what was the guy's name? It was nice and delicious.
Was it Sal or something?
It was Salah. I'm going to get the name right. I just don't want to get sued by someone. And I'm sure past orders. Here we go. This is good. So it tells us everything. Suleiman.
That's it.
Thanks, Suleiman. The food was timely. It was hot.
Yeah.
It was in one piece. I really enjoyed it. So thank you. All right. So now what I want to get into now, obviously, let's have a bit of fun. So obviously we started in our discussion about piracy and all that sort of stuff, and that's always good fun, right? But you know, you have based your whole genre in your music around that era that was just encapsulated. Well, between, let's say, this mid-70s to like mid-80s, is that sort of that?
I'd probably say more. I mean, some of it is actually from like when we do more instrumental music.
Yeah.
Kind of covering through that era of the 70s, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Through to the 80s.
So someone today told me, and the she will go unnamed, Jeanette, that somebody grabbed all the history of Eurovision songs and fed it into an AI, and the AI came up...
It became Angela Merkel.
came up with its own Eurovision song. And apparently it's pretty good.
It was a pure sine wave. It was a dial tone.
No, it had all the essence of like ABBA, Waterloo, and you know, like Carlotta.
Carlotta.
It was all there. It was just like an ensemble of all these
a melange.
So how far away are we from having music generated by computers since
oh, it's already happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's already happening. But whether it's actually going to have any effect,
yeah,
is the question. Because there's already algorithms and there's already a lot of software around that can do pieces of what we're talking about. And AI is constantly being evolved and
yeah,
what have you. But whether it's going to actually write things that are meaningful to other humans is the question.
Yeah, because we've seen this over a long time, right? So obviously the latest iteration of this is K-pop, right? It's a formula. It's written the same way. Then we had Stock Aitken and Waterman. Remember those guys? Those hit.
I remember them well.
Those hit makers from back in the day. And then we go back to Motown, right? And obviously, it's someone saying, hey, no, music should sound like this.
Mm.
Let's stick this into our AI. Mm-hmm. And so if people aren't fickle, especially with pop music, right? So, you know, people like specific tunes and specific keys, and giving more of that, and they'll keep on buying it.
Yeah, in some ways, it's kind of like what you're exposed to dictates what you're going to, what you could possibly like in the future, because your earliest memories of what you listened to and what influenced you would be it's going to be something that's going that will affect you later on.
Yeah.
So, and that's probably what's going to influence you. So, it really depends on what gets you in that period of time when you're in your formative years of your. Listening experience as a music person.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully they'll also like Kylie Minogue, and I'll be really happy for the rest of my life into my geriatric days. I should be so happy, as the song goes. Hey, so we were talking earlier on today. So Depeche Mode have come out and done a song. Who have we seen in the past few years? We've saw Culture Clubs come back. We've seen kind of a lot of bands either running out of money,
Well, that's what's going on. I think a lot of artists are because of the fact that there's a lot of streaming platforms and it's dried up the cash flow, really.
Yeah.
So a lot of artists who would have relied on royalties are now forced to go out and play.
So is that because someone would have to pay more for a CD in the old days and they would get more royalty as opposed to a fraction of a cent now that the song's listened to on Spotify?
Yeah, that's partly true, yeah. Yeah, because online streaming is really just getting through on a technicality, because essentially they're still downloading the material onto your device, but they're saying, oh no, it's streaming, but it's still downloading onto your device, so you're still there.
Yeah.
But they're saying, oh no, so because it's classed as streaming, they'll only give you a fraction of a cent.
Yeah, that's kind of tricky. I remember just a few years ago, somebody...
It's not there permanently.
That's
the thing.
And a lot of... Obviously, it's all the fine print, right, that none of us ever read. Maybe you do, Albert. But there was this...
I don't even know how to read.
There was this case in the United States where a lady's husband passed away, and he had an extensive iTunes library, right? So the minute he passed away, obviously he couldn't log into his account and all that music was gone, right? So the lady took Apple to court. She says, hey, I want that music back that my husband spent hundreds and hundreds of dollars on. And they said, well, your husband never owned that music. He actually rented it.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's kind of scary, because I used to love collecting my CDs and my DVDs and Blu-rays, because I can always go back to them whenever I wanted. But now everyone's relying on this constant streaming, this online content. Yeah,
well, that's I've recently switched from Spotify to Tidal, and all my playlists are gone from Spotify, obviously. So I'm reliant on whatever I can remember on Tidal and put together myself.
Yeah.
So it's just something that you kind of take a risk when you're doing that. You think, well, you know, I don't want this service anymore. So you do lose those playlists. You lose all that material that you've accumulated over that time.
Yeah. So buyer beware, I think, is the... it's like
it's a way they hook you in, though.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because if they're like, oh, well, all my material, all the playlists, everything that I've always kept... It's all on there, and if I disconnect it, it's gone. I've got to rebuild it from scratch somewhere else.
Yeah. They lock you into that ecosystem, so you obviously don't...
Yeah, absolutely.
So you don't want to ever leave it.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's always difficult, because I'm never that guy that... I like to pay sometimes when it's a movie, for example, that I think it's mediocre. I don't bother buying it, so I watch it online. And I'm still the guy that if I like it, that much, I will go and buy the media, because I know that I'm forever going to have that. Unlike your situation with your floppy disks and whatever, there's always a way to get that data back if you really wanted to. You know, there's companies that do this, you know, for a living. For me, I think if you love it, just buy the hard media.
It's becoming harder and harder to get it, though, like, because of everything's becoming cloud-based, I think, and the faster our computers get and connections get, except in Australia, because our connections are still basically concrete, the faster they theoretically can be, then they'll become more and more cloud-based.
Yeah.
And so And I think a lot of companies want to move in that direction.
Yeah. I mean, I remember a Telstra rep one time told me when I had my little Nokia phone with like, I think it was like 500 megabytes of, you know, like storage. And I said, oh, these phones are so terrible. When am I going to get more storage? He said, you're not going to need any more storage because you're going to be streaming everything from the internet.
Mm.
And all I can think of is...
But he thought you were in Korea or somewhere with fast internet.
That's right. That's right. Maybe, yeah, in Australia, maybe another 20 years on top of that.
Maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But we're still going to go through copper.
That's right.
Because we love copper in Australia. Copper art.
There's put some copper on your roof. Yeah, everything's copper in Australia.
In Australia, pretty much everything, cars, like diamonds... Everything's made of copper.
That's crazy. I mean, Albert's camera is overheating, so...
That's just because it's me.
It's just for... All right, so what's going to be happening in the calendar for Naropa in the next up-and-coming months?
Yeah, so we're promoting our album. We're in the process of organising some live performances. Networking. We're working on releasing a single, so I'm remixing some material from the album at the moment to put out a single, and taking it from there. So we're really excited. We're really happy with this album. We think it's our best album to date.
Very, very good. Now, I wish I had some influence and followers online because I really would like to plug it. But I'm sure when we start using search engine optimization, this video will pop up and, you know, people will see you. Who care? We don't care about subscribers anymore because obviously it's, you know, we're searchable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I like I said, as a longtime friend and supporter of Naropa, I did enjoy the album.
Thank you, and
hopefully people actually get to enjoy this conversation that we've had about the past, the present, and hopefully the future. Now, when Naropa creates that electronic robotic album that you don't ever have to even record, then
we're not going away. We're just basically going to be here forever.
It'll be the Terminator Arnold Schwarzenegger version of Naropa. Yeah. It'll create.
I'll be so. Back.
All righty. So, last parting words. Obviously, thank you very much. Hopefully, for those people that are watching this podcast, I've had lots of fun talking about this. There's so many more things that we could talk about. Obviously, next time we will talk sci-fi because Albert's also a big.
I'm a total geek.
You're a total geek sci-fi guy. But that's a thing, and I think it's that scary part about sci-fi that you and I have loved for many decades is the fact that we always thought it was fiction, science. Fiction, and unfortunately, pardon my French, but all this shit's becoming real, which is, I think, it's a conversation all on its own next time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, beautiful. Thank you, Albert.
Thanks, man.
It was a pleasure having you.
Likewise, thank you for having me.
All the best of luck with Naropa's new album, and I can't wait to get into my stiletto shirt. Looking forward to it to wear it proudly. Peace out.
Peace out.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.